Good evening, and welcome to Behind the News for June 9, 2005. This is Doug Henwood. We're looking, as we do many, even most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Got two segments lined up tonight. First, we'll speak with Mustafa Bayoumi, who wrote a piece in the London Review of Books a couple of weeks ago about his visit to Lebanon and his experience on the ground of was presented here as the Cedar Revolution. What was going on the ground when our media were interpreting it as a great eruption of democracy in the Middle East? We'll get to Mustafa's view on that. Mustafa, professor of English at Brooklyn College. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Joel Covell, who is a professor of, what is his exact title? I think he holds the Alger Hiss Chair, which is one of the stranger chairs in academia at Bard College. And he's the author of a book that came out several years ago, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism, or The End of the World. We'll talk to him about those sorts of high-minded things. But also, Joel recently visited Israel for the first time, and I want to hear what he has to say about his impressions of that visit at the bottom of the hour. And before we get to all that, just a few words on the economic headlines. First of all, last week, last Friday, the U.S. Monthly Employment Report was released, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported just 78,000 new jobs were created in May. That's considerably below recent averages, which are about, depending upon when you start, from 180 or 200,000 a month, and way below what we saw in April, 274,000. That number for April got a lot of people thinking that the long sluggishness in the job market was finally over and it was accelerating to something like a normal pace. A normal pace or long-term average would be about 220,000, 230,000 new jobs a month. Well, the job market, again, proving it's a fickle companion. Just 78,000 new jobs in May and not very widely distributed across industrial sectors manufacturing losing jobs again. It's for the third consecutive month. Just 18,000 jobs above its cycle low, which was reached in February 2004. Factory employment now 3.3 million below what it was in March 1998 when it peaked. About 2 years before the broad economy did, 3 years before the broad economy did. So manufacturing went through almost 4 years of losing jobs, gained a few over the last several months, but now it's losing again. So the U.S. manufacturing in dire shape if you're trying to work there. And, of course, we heard a few days ago that GM is planning to lay off 25,000 workers. And it is now a fraction of its former self. So the skill of making things in this country rapidly disappearing. Actually, also, average hourly earnings rose by a very modest amount, lagging inflation. The year-on-year real wage change is almost a loss of 1%. That is, adjusting for inflation, we're pretty close to a 1% loss year-on-year in the value of the average hourly wage. That's a very weak number since we're now 3 years into an economic expansion. The unemployment rate looks kind of low at 5.1%, but the job market is just not really satisfying. It's not producing jobs. It's not producing income growth. It's not normal. There's something seriously wrong going on here. However, it was reported this morning that last week initial claims for jobless insurance, that is people who just lost their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits, that was off by 21,000 last week. But it's been bouncing between about 330,000 and 350,000 now for quite a long time. So the job market, by that measure, not weak, but not really thriving either, and that's what a lot of other measures look like. It does seem, though, that consumer moods are picking up slightly after taking a steep dive in February and March. The ABC News, Washington Post weekly measure of consumer attitudes gained a point last week and picking up now 6 points off its low achieved in the middle of May. So it does seem to be affected by gasoline prices. Gas prices had stabilized for a while, consumer moods improving, but still We should see something much, much stronger, much more. We should see much more consumer optimism than we are now if this were really a normal economic expansion. It's not. But one thing that keeps people happy is low interest rates. Despite the Federal Reserve pushing up short-term rates, long-term rates are pretty low, and mortgage rates are very low. And it looks like mortgage demand is picking up again. People buying houses. The housing bubble continues unabated. It had been showing some signs of cracking, but not too serious. And whenever you think it's about to give up, it finds a new sign of life. And it does look like, again, that people are refinancing their mortgages. And when they do that, they generally take out some fresh cash, borrowing against the alleged appreciation in the value of their houses, and spend the money. That's one of the things that's kept consumption going for the last several years. And it does seem that people are continuing to do that. However, other measures of the U.S. economy are showing a slowdown, not contraction yet, but a slowdown. The survey of purchasing managers done by the Institute for Supply Management declining in the service sector in May, now for the second consecutive month. And if you look at it in a chart, it's been a kind of a rough downtrend now for close to a year. So the service sector does seem to be slowing down, still expanding, but not as rapidly. And their ISM's measure of manufacturing declined in the month of May also. And it's down pretty much consecutively, with little interruption since last July. So factory sector, by this measure, still growing slowly, but employment now contracting by this measure. So things are just not doing so well with the job market and the broader U.S. economy showing signs of a slowdown. And the rest of the world's economy is also either slowing down or entering outright recession. Italy now appears to be in recession. Most of the larger economies in continental Europe on the verge of recession. And the French and Dutch votes against the constitution in Europe over the last couple of weeks, suggesting considerable political discontent with the direction of European economic policy. But also, for those of people who are hoping that there would be some kind of meeting with destiny, the people who cheerlead for crisis, who are looking for some kind of crisis in the U.S. dollar, some crisis with the U.S. funding its vast debts abroad. That kind of crisis seems a little less likely now that the euro is looking like a less attractive alternative to the dollar. So, it's just this is what gave the discipline of economics the nickname of the dismal science. But unfortunately, the economies of the world mostly looking fairly dismal for the most part. So let's take a musical break, and then we'll come back with Mustafa Bayoumi. And that was an excerpt from Six Bagatelles by Anton Webern, performed by the Kronos Quartet. The Kronos Quartet also performs the theme for this program, which I only identify every now and then. It's I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Washishije, Our Beginning, which is composed by Odo Adi and appears on the album Pieces of Africa from the Kronos Quartet. And I inherited that theme from the much-missed Samori Marksman. And now we're joined on the line by Mustafa Bayoumi, who is a co-editor along with Andrew Rubin of the Edward Said Reader, and also a professor of English at Brooklyn College, author of a piece, the diary column of the London Review of Books, May 5th issue, on his visit to Beirut, what our media called the Cedar Revolution, although it doesn't seem that anybody in Lebanon called it that, was unfolding last March. And we also see in on the wires that there was an election in southern Lebanon last Sunday, and a Hezbollah ticket swept that election. So Lebanon very much in the news. Welcome to WBAI, Mustafa.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, any thoughts on the election results from last weekend?
Well, I think that, as you said, Hezbollah did very well in the election, and it really should come as no surprise to the Lebanese or people who follow Lebanese politics. It may have come as a surprise to the American political establishment or to the Israeli government. I think that they thought that their pressure on the Syrians would mean that the influence of Hezbollah would wane in Lebanon. But in fact, what we've seen is quite the contrary. Hezbollah is changing itself into very much a Lebanese political party, and they have a lot of opportunity to make themselves into real political players in the scene there.
So to the American mind, Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. Syria is a foreign occupier, and the Lebanese have been aching to throw off the yoke of terrorism and oppression for ages now. Could you correct the American mind?
I wish I could correct the American
That's
mind.
A long task, but at least fact-check this version of the American mind.
Well, okay, let's try to parse what you were just saying. Hezbollah is considered a terrorist organization by the United States government, mostly because of the bombing of an American base in the 1980s during the Lebanese Civil War, I think one is hard-pressed to actually call that terrorism, since that was a military target. Hezbollah also, though, is engaged in cross-border altercations with Israel, both of them along the southern border of Lebanon and Israel. And in fact, of course, the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982, and they occupied southern Lebanon to the point that the Hezbollah made it difficult enough for Israel so that the Israelis left in the year 2000, and which is what actually gave a lot of support to Hezbollah in the long run.
Yeah, it's not too many people who kick Israel out of anywhere, is it?
There's not actually, most Lebanese, almost all Lebanese, will tell you now that they are actually quite proud of Hezbollah for that fact. They are supported financially and militarily by Syria and by Iran. Now, Hezbollah is a Shia organization. It reflects the complicated nature of what the Middle East is all about. I think you could also say, though, that Israel is heavily supported by the United States, both militarily and politically and in many other ways, which continues to reflect the complicated political nature of the region.
Well, what does Syria want in Lebanon?
Well, that's also actually a very difficult and long-standing question. To some people, they consider that Syria is, in fact, a colonial construction, and Lebanon is a colonial construction, and that Syria and Lebanon share one culture called Greater Syria, and that you can see that the mandate of Lebanon was made by the French in the Sykes-Picot Act after the demise of the Ottoman Empire and the end of the First World War. Mount Lebanon was a mostly Christian area, and the way that the French carved the borders between Lebanon and Syria was to make Lebanon a basically evenly split region between Christians and Muslims. And that way the French, who were very close to the Maronite Christians, would continue to have some kind of influence inside of the region. So a lot of people will actually argue that, in fact, Lebanon is a very artificial or modern construct, particularly people who belong to a more Syrian nationalist paradigm would see it that way. Of course, not all Lebanese will agree with that, and many Lebanese will say that they have their own culture. That's a Phoenician culture that will go all the way back thousands of years. And, these are again, longstanding issues that have yet to be resolved.
And to turn to your piece in London Review of Books, you happened to be visiting Lebanon when our media dubbed the Cedar Revolution was unfolding last March. But first of all, you open the piece by recounting your browsing in the Virgin Megastore.
Right.
And you also say that people like to congregate at the Dunkin' Donuts.
Right.
These are not brand names one associates with the Middle East necessarily. How much of this kind of presence is there in Beirut and in surrounding areas?
Quite a bit. Actually, there's a lot in Beirut, and in fact, it's kind of tragic. Beirut is, well known for its delightful cuisine, And this is the downtown Beirut has been reconstructed after the end of the Civil War in 1990, and now you have restaurants like TGIF and Dunkin' Donuts there, you know, which, to my mind, is a great tragedy.
This is a crime against nature and civilization at
yes,
once.
Yes, I think so. Of course, downtown Beirut was reconstructed by Rafiq Hariri, the man who was, in fact, assassinated on February 14th, and his company, Solidaire, which was largely responsible, in the minds of many, too, for the economic massive Lebanese debt that they have and the sort of failures of their own economy. So, again, it's part of I think it's very much a part of globalization. It's very much a part of what isn't confronting the rest of the world, and it's very true in the Middle East. It's, what you say is actually very true. I think to the general American mindset, you think of still think of the Middle East as some place that's relatively primitive. It doesn't have even, I don't know, internet cafes, for example. Well, actually, the internet is a huge thing all over the Middle East. And whether you're in Egypt or whether you're in Lebanon, you can still get your McDonald's hamburger at the same time that you can be checking your email on your wireless phone, and you know, et cetera, et cetera.
And the murder of Hariri, of course, was blamed on Syria and gave rise to demonstrations. What's your analysis of that sequence of events?
Well, we'll probably never know, I think, who was actually responsible for the assassination of Hariri. There is some indication that that it could have been Syrian intelligence forces that were behind it. This is the UN had a fact-finding commission after the assassination, and they tended in that direction. There are also Lebanese intelligence services who are working for the Syrian intelligence services. It's you know, I think it actually is possible that is the case. While I was in Beirut, you also heard other kinds of theories that would say that the Americans had been behind it or that the Israelis had been behind it. There's probably less evidence for that, but there certainly is a historical precedent, particularly for the Israelis. You know, there were at least two other car bomb assassinations, the most recent being Ili Hubeya, who was set to testify against Ariel Sharon because of the Sabra Chatila massacre, and he was going to testify in Brussels because there was a lawsuit that had been put against Ariel Sharon for that massacre. And
hard to believe the Syrians would be behind that particular assassination.
Yes, in fact, I think hardly anybody actually would believe the Syrians would be behind that one. And most learned commentators actually understand that the Israelis were behind that. And that was a car bomb in Lebanon as well. So unfortunately, what that means is that there are too many foreign violent interventions in the small country of Lebanon.
Yeah, poor Lebanon. I'm speaking with Mustafa Bayoumi, who is a professor of English at Brooklyn College, and author of a piece in London Review of Books from May 5th about his visit to Lebanon during the so-called Cedar Revolution. And as you point out, no one in Lebanon was actually using that phrase, which our government and media seized upon, right?
Yeah.
What did you see? You were visiting some of the camp that people had built a little camp, and there was sort of a permanent demonstration going on.
Right.
What did you see there?
It was. I have to say, I mean, it was a very exciting place to be. There was a lot of activity. It was a tent city that was right in downtown Beirut. I guess the equivalent would, right where it is Martyrs Square, so it looks more like a parking lot. But imagine if Central Park were like a parking lot, and there were a tent city right there. I think that could be the kind of equivalent in the New York context.
Of course, NYPD wouldn't tolerate that for a second.
That's right. And in fact, it's quite remarkable that the Lebanese police did tolerate it, which also illustrates the way in which the regime did allow the demonstrations to go forward.
Were people there? What point were they trying to make?
They were there because they wanted a few things. There were signs everywhere, all over Beirut, that said al-haqiqa, which means the truth. We want the truth. Who was the one who was behind the assassination of Hariri? They also wanted.
Was he particularly popular? Was there a sense of loss?
He was incredibly popular. Particularly, I think martyrdom has a way of escalating popularity automatically in many people. But even before his martyrdom, he was in fact a very popular man. He was extremely wealthy, but he was also a self-made man from Saida, from the south of Lebanon. And that quality, I think, gave him a certain amount of integrity, or perceived integrity, anyways, inside of Lebanon. He worked very closely with the Saudis. That's where he made his money. He was initially a school teacher, and then he worked for a construction company, started his own construction company. And then he was in charge of rebuilding downtown Lebanon, downtown Beirut, as I said, through his own construction company and a lot of Saudi money.
Who financed that rebuilding? Saudis and foreign borrowing, too?
That's right, mainly the Gulf. And in fact, that's what people complain about. That in fact, only people from the Gulf who are very wealthy and come in summer in Beirut can afford to live downtown because it's very expensive. Whereas there's still an enormous amount of poverty that is in Beirut. You won't see it if you go as a tourist only and you stay right downtown Beirut. But if you go just a little bit outside of the city, you'll see that there are actually large slum areas that ring the whole city.
And so, was it anything like it was portrayed here?
The
demonstrations, the feeling, the sentiments of the people who were gathered. You know, it was here as presented as yet another one of these. They had run out of colors, I guess, so now they're going to trees. The Cedar Revolution,
right?
But another one of these, you know, revolutions that last two or three days and are taken as a great a lust for American style democracy, and then it disappears from the media. But is it anything like that? What you saw?
I think that what it really was, particularly I was staying hanging out in the camp with the young people. And I was particularly attracted to, and I ended up spending my time with, a group of independents. They were not actually affiliated with any of the old Lebanese political parties. So they had a very different and I think very authentic and a lot of integrity in what they were believing in. And what they really wanted was a new Lebanon that was free of its sectarian differences. And I actually believe that that was a very earnest and something that they were willing to fight for. However, what you did see in the rest of the camp, though, was a lot of the old groups, the old sectarian political parties manifesting themselves. I would say that the camp was actually made up mostly, at least initially, by people who were from the Lebanese Forces Party and from the Michel Aoun's Free Patriotic Movement Party. These are two Christian groups in a country that's very heavily riven by its sectarian differences. So there it becomes even more complicated, because I think that some of those people would be spouting the rhetoric of a unified Lebanon, of a Lebanon that's free of its prior sectarian past, and yet when it comes down to it, they're still actually interested mostly in protecting their own community, and even if that means at the expense of others. And I think that what you've seen actually post-Syrian withdrawal and in these first two stages of the election is precisely that. We've seen a return to the old sectarian model in Lebanon. We've seen the advancement of the whole electioneering and the ways in which the certain parties would make alliances with other parties in order for their own communitarian interests, et cetera, et cetera. There's been very little talk of united Lebanon actually post-Syrian withdrawal, which is not a good development.
And could you give us the rundown of, like, just who are all these interests and parties? Are they religious? Are they political differences? Some combination of those things?
On the face of it, they're all religious differences. Lebanon has 18 different recognized religions. So it's a very complex, diverse, small country. Lebanon also has not had an official census for something like 60 years. The reason being, of course, that is if they did do a census, then that would really upset the balance. Lebanon, as I was saying earlier, was originally organized around the notion that there would be about 50% Muslim and 50% Christian in the population, in the parliament, in the way in which power is distributed, et cetera, et cetera. If you were to do a census today, no doubt ratio has been upset, and that there are fewer Christians now and more Muslims. And nobody wants to do that, because these sectarian differences actually were also what led to the Civil War. But even there, then it becomes very complicated. And in fact, if you look at the Civil War, you'll see that the Syrians were invited in first to enter Lebanon to protect the Christian groups, and then their allegiances switched to the Muslim groups later on, and allegiances were shifting all the time until at the end of the war you had Aoun and Jaja. These are two different Christian leaders fighting each other. So a lot of it is in the guise of sectarian difference, but a lot of it ends up being communitarian fighting over community as opposed to sect or belief, or sometimes foreign intervention with the invasion of Israel and the support that the Israelis gave the Falange Party. Saddam Hussein was also actually a major weapon supplier during the Lebanese Civil War as well. So there are too many external players inside of Lebanon, and there's not enough unity also inside of Lebanon.
And is there any hope for that kind of unity in the future, or do you see more of the same going forward?
I think if your listeners were to actually read my piece, they would see that I end up actually on a rather pessimistic note. I did feel in the beginning that there was something really special happening there, because you don't have a lot of massive popular demonstrations going on anywhere in the repressive political culture of the Middle East. So there was something quite new that was going on there. And yet at the end, I did feel like the old sectarian differences were rearing their ugly heads once again. And so I'm not really, sadly, optimistic about at least the near future in Lebanon.
And I noticed in the biographical note in the London Review, it says you're working on a book called How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Dispatches from Arab America. So could you give us a little teaser about what that's going to be about?
Sure. Well, the title, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem, of course, is drawn from Du Bois. This is his, you see, in The Souls of Black Folk, he asks that question. Since the whole of the United States is wondering what it actually means to be, not so much wondering, has an opinion about what it means to be an African-American back in, say, 1900. I think you see something very similar right now. Everybody has an opinion about what it means to be an Arab or a Muslim in the United States, even though I think most of them don't know any Arabs or Muslims in the United States. This book is an attempt to try to give some sense of what the human cost has been, really, domestically, to the Arab and Muslim community post 9/11. But I don't want to focus solely on sort of victims of state repression, because I think that Arab life is actually much more complicated than that in the United States. So instead, it's focusing on Arab American youth culture, and particularly Arab American youth culture in Brooklyn, New York. And I'm interested in seeing how the post 9/11 period has impacted them and what their kinds of aspirations and hopes are now after that traumatic event.
All right, well, looking forward to that. Thank you for joining us, Mustafa Bayoumi.
Thank you very much.
Mustafa is a professor of English at Brooklyn College and author of a piece in London Review of Books, May 5th issue, on his visit to Lebanon during the demonstrations in that country. Let's take a little break, and we should be back with Joel Covell.
Hi, this is Danny Glovin. You're tuned into WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
And we're back here. The program is Behind the News. Doug Henwood is my name. And just before you heard from Danny Glover, you heard from Antoine Vebrin a little bit more from the Six Bagatelles performed by the Kronos Quartet. And now we're joined in the studio by Joel Covell, who is a holds the Alger Hiss chair.
No, I don't.
You don't? No. That was one of the best named chairs.
I know.
I
loved it, but I've been stripped of it.
Yeah. Oh, that's too bad.
For being the memory lives on.
Okay.
I still teach it.
At Bard College.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And author of a book from several years ago, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism, The End of the World, or The End of the World. Are you the editor now of Capitalism, Nature, Socialism?
That's right. I do that, too.
Yes. Journal. Great distinction founded by James O'Connor about, 15 years ago?
88.
Yeah, 88, yeah. Oh, 17 years ago.
Yeah.
So you've just been to Israel for the first time in your life, right?
That's correct.
You didn't have one of those Jewish youthful rites of passage where you made...
Well, I did, but I assiduously refused it.
So what were your impressions?
Well, you know, I didn't go for a reason. I never... like what was happening there, and though my mother kept trying to make me go, so I kept refusing. But I'm glad I went, because it's, you know, it's important to see the world even if you don't like what you see. I am working on a book on the subject, and I felt it would be a pretty empty book if it was written without any firsthand exposure. And although the book would be probably the same kind of book without me going, there's a certain vividness and edge, and also a sense of somewhat greater hopefulness and possibility after I've been there, although by no means diminution in my very fundamental criticism of the situation in that area. You know.
My friend Joel Shalit said in this program, as a matter of fact, that Israel needs war because it's its way, otherwise it'd have to confront its own internal contradictions as a society. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. It's had to declare a state of emergency every year that it's existed. It's never not had a state of emergency. And there are unbearable contradictions built into the whole notion of Zionism. And once Zionism got its long sought after state, those contradictions just became more acute, more deadly.
What are some of those contradictions you're talking about?
Well, I mean, the basic contradiction is that you can have a democratic state for one people, you know, and it's an amazingly bad idea if you think about it, you know. I mean, I understand if you want a place for one kind of people, that's all right, but then to call it a democratic state is pretty grotesque, really. And yet this idea...
But there are substantial divisions even within those that alleged one people, aren't there?
Oh, a lot of divisions. They're papered over by this furious ideological barrage, where to criticize Israel means you're anti-Semitic, that you're calling for the annihilation of the Jews, and so on and so forth.
But
so,
isn't that sort of criticism more effective here than it is in Israel?
Yes and no. It's still effective in Israel. And there is a. I was really impressed with what a totalitarian society it is, and how it's a place where.
Now that contradicts the standard image of its status as a beacon of democracy in a harsh neighborhood.
Right. I think that's utterly false. Because when you get there, you can see. Of course, there are many different kinds of people, but the aura within which they're encased is one that there's only one kind of people that counts. You know, the only thing that matters is the fate of the Jews. And it's the only, you look at the press, and it never mentions anybody else. I went to the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, a good museum with all kinds of very interesting modernist paintings and a lot of exhibits from Israel. A large museum, about the size of the Whitney or the Guggenheim, maybe bigger. And not a single representation of a non-European person in the whole museum. That's the sort of thing. And so it's actually, that's... there's a lot of diversity, but the diversity doesn't really mingle or mix with each other. I mean, there. I mean, 20% of the Israel part of the country, setting aside the West Bank, is Arab, but these are third class citizens, and more than that, there's just no meeting of the eyes, really. Of course, there are exceptions at the edges. Any society of a few million people, and there's a saving remnant because the. There is a very active debate amongst intellectuals there, and with a lot of intense work trying to build bridges and trying to look beyond the Zionist state and so on. In that sense, it's much further along than the United States, where that needed debate is really missing. And it's what I'm trying to get going, what I think we need very much, is to have a debate that's serious about the future of Israel and not that doesn't get caught up in the question of does it have a right to exist, or does it, you know, is it going, are they going to push the Jews into the sea, and so on. These kinds of hysterical and you know, grim scenarios that get trundled out anytime somebody dares to criticize what's going on. That debate doesn't happen at all here. It happens in Israel, although it's marginalized. On the other hand, it will not go away. It can't go away because the contradictions are so severe.
Israel, whether it has a right to exist or not, does, and it's not likely to go away anytime soon, so it would seem important to just move on from that fact on the ground.
Well, I tell people, tell me a state that has the right to exist. No state has the right to exist, does it? I mean, you know what I mean? The states, I thought the point about states were whether they have to prove their bona fides according to human rights if they have a right to exist. And I don't think the United States has a right to exist. I don't think, you know, to say a state has a sort of, inalienable right to exist is to worship the state, really. It's to say that the state is more than a contract between people, you know. It's to deify
it. It's given to us by God.
Somehow, yes, yeah. God, and which is exactly the point. And that's one of
that's one of the things that joins Israel and the United States. We both have a sense of divine mission, right?
Yes. There are a lot of deep, interesting, and complex residences.
And appropriated territory.
Yes, yeah, appropriated territory and settler colonialism, basically. I think there are four societies that bear comparison. One is the United States. The other is Nazi Germany. Third is apartheid South Africa, and the fourth is Israel. And these are all states that have had built-in racist structures, you know, where the very state compact consisted of a racist structure. And people don't realize it's something that we need a category called state racism, where it's not just a matter of civil society and people, you know, grousing and fighting for scarce goods and so on, but where the actual structure of the law and the institutions are rendered so you can guarantee a racist outcome. And when you have that, I mean, you're faced with the choice of either you're going to tolerate this racist outcome or you're going to say that state should not exist anymore. And in this country, of course, it led very complex, you know, the Civil War, and then the state racism came back, Jim Crow, civil rights movement. Got rid of that. Now the state racism is back again, you know, disenfranchisement. So it's not a simple absolute, but it's, you know, it's a phenomenon. We still have state racism in this country, although it's not formalized. And so you can get a person of African descent being Secretary of State. You're never going to get an Arab being foreign minister of Israel under the current Israeli state situation, just as you would never have gotten a black person the foreign minister of South Africa under apartheid. Those three societies are really very analogous because they're all, in all each case, the settler group is messianically informed. They obey the Old Testament rather than the New Testament. And they have a covenant psychology. You know, God promised us this land. And so the case of Nazi Germany is different, but of course it's excruciatingly close to the Israeli experience because the Jews are one of the principal, although by no means the only victim of the Nazi persecutions and annihilations. But, you know, I think we should keep all those states in mind and we should take the point of view. The basic thesis I want to emphasize is that I don't see any reason why we should not treat Israel with the same degree of disrespect that we treated apartheid South Africa.
But of course, it gets $3 billion a year in public aid and another $3 billion in private aid. So
there are causes.
Quite the contrary.
There are causes, and there is an immense lobby in the United States, and there is powerful, constantly stirred up mythologies about the Holocaust, which have to be dealt with. You know, without denying the Holocaust, but really understanding what this has meant and how it's used, how it's abused. And it's used and abused in Israel also. One of the amazing things I discovered there, they have a separate but unequal educational system that was installed in 1953, 1 year before, you know, we tried to get rid of ours here. So there's separate, parallel Israeli and Arab public school systems. But the curriculum for each of them is written in Hebrew and emphasizes the Jewish experience and the Holocaust, but not the Nakba, which is the Arab analog, Palestinian, you know, homolog of the Nakba, their own moment of disgrace, their ethnic cleansing and so forth. So that's left out. Of course, the Arabs will bring it in informally, but it's left out within the official curriculum that the state tries to impose. And that's what one means by state racism. You know, it's very much ingrained in the formal institutional structure of the country.
I'm speaking with Joel Covell, who's the editor of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, professor at Bard College, and just back from a trip to Israel. Yeah. Was first. You said you came back with some shred of hope. What was that?
Well, first of all, there are some wonderful people over there, I mean, on all sides. Palestinians I met were very inspiring. Their civil society is very strongly developed, very resilient. They deal with adversity extremely well.
They've had a lot of practice.
Yes, they've had a lot of training. but, you know, misery can lead to nihilism and so on. But of course, I can't speak for every Palestinian, but I can speak for every Palestinian I met, and I met quite a few. But it hasn't there. I mean, I was struck going through one of the camps. There are a bunch of kids around, young adolescents, and I said, "Well, do any of these kids form gangs?" They said, "Oh, no, they can't. They don't have a gang. You know, they're not. They don't fight each other. You know, they know they have to gather together and be strong." But the same token, I found them very forgiving and not at all vindictive, which is remarkable considering what they go through every day, which is really quite atrocious. Very forbearing and yet, you know, very resolute. And there are, you know, there's a, the whole notion of Judaism is caught up in a dialectic between universality and, you know, tribalism. And basically the tribalist impulses have been reinforced by Zionism, but the universalist impulses, which gave us, you know, Marx and Einstein and people like that, still persist within elements of the Jewish...
Non-Jewish,
as Isaac Deutsch would say, yes. And that's how I would identify myself as well. I think this is the best way to be Jewish.
I saw Bertel Ullman a while back, and he said all of us Goyim on the left should convert to Judaism, and that would really screw up
that's another
the
way
Zionist
of doing
model.
Well, Bertel says Bertel becomes like a Jewish non-Jew, and I'm trying to be a non-Jewish Jew. Slice it and dice it. But I think it's a wonderful tradition, and that tradition persists there. I mean, there are tremendous numbers of resistors. I don't mean a tremendous number, but it's there. One of the days, there was a unfortunately not atypical shooting of some Palestinian youth, and within a few hours, there had been a demonstration gathering in front of the Ministry of Defense, so-called the IDF, in Tel Aviv, and there were really two generations there. There was the old folks who were in remnants of the old Socialist Internationalists left, and they were very good, and a lot of people I knew and have corresponded with and so on. But there's a substantial group of young people there, young Israelis. How many, I can't count. But, I mean, they were there in force at this demonstration. And they call themselves anarchists, but they're anarchists not philosophically, but in this, you know, or doctrinally, but really in the sense of not taking anybody's line. And they just resonate to justice and injustice. And they see the monstrous injustice that is being done to the fellow human beings that inhabit this territory. And so many of them go and live with the Palestinians, or they're constantly there working for them and working with them. And there are many really interesting initiatives. There's a group called Zochrot, Z-O-C-H-R-O-T, which is a Hebrew verb which means to acknowledge, and which simply works, although it's not simple, to try to restore historical memory. You know, because in 1948, for instance, there were 531 towns that were erased, just erased, you know, rubbed off the map. And but they all have place names, you know. So this group will go around and make like signs, you know. Here is the village of El Kai, whatever, and they'll put it up, you know. And somebody will come and take it down, but you know, they'll come and put it back up again. So there's always this question of recognition of the other, you know, making, because then you can't, the stupid Israeli government is putting up this massive wall, as you know, which is really a horror. And it succeeds in getting the idea of the Arab out of a lot of people's minds, but, you know, you can't. You can't wall off.
Oh, wall kind of attracts attention to itself.
Yeah, that's
too.
Right. And this one is very big and it's very ugly and it's frightening. And a lot of people are very upset by it. You know? Also, by the way, the Palestinians say, there's a million ways to get around it.
Yeah. Some years ago, I think 4 or 5 years ago, there was a roundtable in Harper's Magazine among a bunch of Israeli soldiers.
Uh-huh.
And the range of opinion that they expressed was truly extraordinary, ranging from the guys who liked the sport of shooting Palestinians to people who were really tortured by what they were doing.
Tormented.
And you know, I had a hard time imagining a group of American soldiers in Iraq saying similar things, but there are some.
Well, remember, the military is every different institution there. It is more or less compulsory, and it's a rite of passage, and it's something that people do when, you know, in their late college years, and, you know, 20, 21, or even 18 or younger, and you'll see soldiers in the IDF walking around the streets or going on leave or going on buses, you know, carrying their submachine guns. So it's a little chilling to see these kids really carrying deadly weapons. But but on the other hand, I mean, you know, many of them just don't look very military, because literally all of them have to go. It's not a volunteer
except the
army.
Extremely religious.
Yeah, and they're the ones who create the biggest problem, because they represent the id, so to speak, of the Zionist mentality. It's amazing how this movement, which was supposed to represent the advanced thrust of European, you know, thought, has finally revealed its inner atavistic core in these insane people. I mean, insane people.
What are you meaning by that?
Well, I mean, I don't insane in a I'm an old shrink, you know.
Yes, you're a psychiatrist.
I missed a certain connection, so I didn't go on this trip with some friends of mine. But some friends went to Hebron, which is actually the most difficult place in the territories. There's a tomb of the patriarchs there, and this is a place where the settlement grew up. And I forget the name of it, but there's 500 ultra-Orthodox settlers there, surrounded by 1,500 very unhappy IDF soldiers who are there simply to protect them, surrounded by 50,000 Arabs. And my friends went to look at it, you know, to see what it was like. So when they went through the streets and they went towards the area of the settlement, and no sooner were they observed than kids came out and started throwing rocks at them, settler kids. I mean, without saying a word. And serious rocks. And these are like 14-year-old boys, some of whom can, you know, throw pretty serious stones. And the parents are all armed.
Is this some sort of paranoid defense of borders?
Some sort of, yeah. It's quite peculiar. You know, to me, it's very, very ironic, because I grew up in Brooklyn. And when I was a kid, I used to see people like this, and never felt any rapport with them. I thought they would sort of wither away with the march of modernity and the Enlightenment and so on, which is what, of course, I was into. And a lot of the settlers actually come from Brooklyn, you know that. And so I'm thinking that I'm seeing the same people that I grew up with in Brooklyn, you know, maybe some of the actual same people, although they're now older and they have their own children there and so forth. And they've achieved a kind of a demonic power over the state apparatus.
Yeah, but this is a small minority of the population, which is not well-liked by a lot of people.
That's right.
So, but how do they exert this kind of power?
They exert this kind of power because they represent, unfortunately, the authentic impulse of the state, you know, which is, you know, the problem is a Jewish state, and they're the only ones who are like serious about it. I mean,
I remember seeing Meir Kahane on Nightline many years ago, and he said, "You know, I am really the face of Zionism. I'm what it's really all about."
And he was right. He was right. And I had a correspondent. I published some articles. And I got a letter from a very friendly fellow, you know, a rabbi, Orthodox rabbi. I mean, and he said, "I totally agree with your logic. It's very, you know, what you're saying is kind of what I'm saying now. I agree with that logic, except I don't accept that principle. That's Hellenistic logic. You know? That's what Alexander the Great tried to introduce, 2,300 years ago, and we don't dig that. I mean, because
their inspiration is 2,700
years ago. 2,700 years ago, we go from what God told Abraham, and that's our logic, and so your logic is okay, but we don't pay any attention to that. Well, that's the logic of Zionism, which is to build this Jewish state by taking other people's land and then saying that you're a democracy. Well, of course, you can't do this. You're just squaring the circle. You just cannot put those two things together. So
when you said they were the id, you meant that.
I perfectly do mean it. Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunately fascinating, you know, but it's by no means appealing. It's a very depressing situation.
What about their connection with our Christian fundamentalists here? Do you see anything?
Well, that's
kind of parallel.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? The connection was laid down by Begin, Prime Minister, in 1982, because after the invasion of Lebanon, it was so unpopular. Even Reagan was furious at the Israelis for doing that, by the way. He had to somehow rally support in the United States, and so he made overtures to the Christian right, and Jerry Falwell particularly. And here's where that fusion, it's not strictly Old Testament, because they're a book of Revelation, but the book of Revelation has the same basic kind of logic as the Old Testament, messianic, apocalyptic, end-of-world kind of ideology. So there was that ideological link, and the other link, of course, is that objectively Israel has become increasingly... is it the tail or the dog of U.S. imperialism in the region? I mean, and this, so it becomes inherently a right-wing project, and inherently a racist, Eurocentric project. There's a marriage of convenience and also a marriage of some sort of ideological affinity, although I think... Jews would be very well advised to stay clear of these people because
they're not known for their affection for Jews.
No, they're not, really. They don't like Jews. They may like Israel, but they don't like Jews.
Yeah. As long as they're safely 5,000 miles
right.
away.
As long as they have the Israel sort of cleaning up the Arabs for them and the Muslims. You know. So it's one of the stranger phenomena of modern times. And, of course, you then have this very curious confluence with the neoconservative group, which now, there's a question, are they waxing or waning in influence? You know, was Wolfowitz, you know, sent out to pasture, et cetera, et cetera? Is he being punished for the disaster of the Iraq War, whatever? But, you know, there's a very interesting reckoning there that you have this group of very right-wing Zionists within first the Reagan, but they were sequestered in the Reagan administration and in the Bush administration. They become, almost hegemonic in terms of the foreign policy initiatives.
But nonetheless, really at the heart of American right-wing thought and organization.
Oh, yeah, you know, yeah.
So it's not really some foreign
This is not just a chance. It's a fascinating, grim, doomed entente, really. I think one reason that you see these kinds of fulsome praises of Israel, like Nancy Pelosi recently or... everybody.
Hillary Clinton,
yeah. It's Democrat, and of course, you know, DeLay and all the Republicans. I think you see this extremely fulsome praise of Israel because that whole alliance is really very, very brittle. And there's a lot of resentment amongst paleo-conservatives for the fact that...
We have their sympathy with the Nazis, so we don't want to get too deeply into that.
Yeah, there's nothing to write home about. But, I mean, they're really furious that they feel that Israel suckered us into this war in the Middle East, which I think is a dreadful oversimplification.
Well, we're out of time. So yeah, I wanted to talk about the enemy of nature. We never got around to that, so you'll have to give him back soon.
I would be delighted to. All right.
Well, thank you for joining us, Joel Covell, professor at Bard, editor of Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, and author of the book Enemy of Nature, among other things. And everyone should check out Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, a vitally important journal with too small a circulation.
Absolutely.
All right. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with a little more of Webern, his orchestration of Bach's fugue from the Musical Offering.
Oh, wow. I want to hear that.